Roger Williams University is hosting a crisis management seminar on May 3rd at their Providence campus. Crises, whether a natural disaster, cyber attack, or financial instability, can have severe repercussions if not handled properly. This is where crisis management plays a pivotal role. Join Roger Williams MBA students and expert speakers to learn how to prepare for the unexpected. The program is totally free and open to the public. You can register online at rwu.edu/events/crisis-management-symposium.
This is the Bartholomew Town Podcast.
Hi, everyone, and welcome once again to another edition of the Bartholomew Town Podcast. It's Bill Bartholomew here with you, as I am for new episodes every Tuesday and Friday. Today, we welcome newly elected State Senator Cynthia Mendez to the program. And Senator Mendez knocked off, really, in frankly humiliating fashion, the Senate Finance Chair, Billy Connolly, in the 2020 Democratic primary, and was one of the, I don't want to say shocking events of that particular primary, but certainly surprised a lot of people. And I think for sure Senator Connolly, former Senator Connolly, and his camp, undoubtedly. And this is a really interesting conversation with Senator Mendez today, because we evaluate, you know, how does change take place? Not even necessarily in the context of political parties or broad ideologies, but just in terms of something that I've been speaking about for a while now, here on the podcast and on other platforms as well. The notion of insider versus outsider in Rhode Island politics. The insider being, you know, those institutionalist elected officials, the lobbyists, the consulting firms, the powerful and wealthy people who help to craft policy, and the outsiders being the rest of the people by and large. You know what I mean? And you can extrapolate that in any number of different ways. And you can say, well, wait a minute. Now, this is a conservative versus liberal thing. This is a tax policy conversation. This is even just a social justice conversation. But I think it's much more broad and generic and simple. And this conversation with Senator Mendez today does a tremendous job of laying out just how simple a thought process it is. Bring the people to power and you'll see a redefined government. You know, bring the vast majority of voices and experiences to the table, you will see a shift in the tectonic plates of what controls the narrative and the end result of public policy making. And I think the same goes for media, the same goes for education, the same goes for all of the pillars, if you will, of our contemporary society. And this, so for that very reason, I really enjoyed this conversation. I also enjoyed it because it was fun to catch up with Senator Mendez for the first time here on the pod, and learn a little bit about her plant life experience as well. So there's a little bit of fun in there. We get into her experiences, painful experiences dealing with COVID-19, her takeaways on where we need to go next. We talk about the roaring 20s potentially, right? And what that will mean for Rhode Island and society as a whole. So lots in there today. Glad to have Senator Mendez on the program, and hopefully you enjoy it as well. And by the way, if you want to support the independent journalism, opinion, analysis, and entertainment that B-Town has become known for, well, simply head to patreon.com/BartholomewTown, where for as little as $3 per month, you may help to sustain this program. That's patreon.com/BartholomewTown. Also, you can send me an email anytime, bill@ripodcast.com. Give me a follow on Twitter and Instagram at Bill Bartholomew, and go ahead and join the Bartholomew Town Podcast Facebook group. I know Facebook, is it relevant? Does anyone care about it? And I'm not so sure that if you post something like, you know, on your page or your personal profile that, I mean, unless you're spending money to promote it, I'm not sure how many people it reaches or who cares, but I have found the Facebook group tool to be really useful and exciting. And we have a lot of great discussions inside the B-Town group. You know, I'll post something, either a story or do some reporting in there, as I do on Twitter and Instagram on a daily basis. I'll post it in the Facebook group. But what's fascinating is that we can have a discussion. It's kind of like the vibe of talk radio, but it's more modern in the sense of like people can leave comments and it's usually your real name on Facebook, right? So it becomes really fascinating, and we can learn a lot about how certain stories or policies or ideas impact different types of people around the state from different backgrounds. And those conversations are really fruitful. So again, that's the Bartholomew Town Podcast Facebook group. Just search Bartholomew Town and you should be able to find it in there. And love to have you involved in those discussions. Okay, let's get right to it. Senator Cynthia Mendez, when we begin this conversation talking about, hey, you know, the Senate, the House, they're not meeting inside the State House. You know, they're not able to stand under the rotunda and get that oh wow moment. And how has that impacted someone who's in their first term? We find out about that and much more here on Rhode Island's podcast of record, B-Town. It's obviously, is there something lost by not walking into the State House and walking instead into Sappersley Hall? And do you feel a little bit like, you know, oh man, I'm not quite getting the full effect here? Or is it okay?
It's okay for me. I think one, because I don't have anything to compare it to.
Yeah.
Because I've only entered those halls as someone, as an outsider kind of speaking up, not as a legislator. And then two, I kind of like that it might help kind of keep me humble and grounded and not really get too kind of excited about all of the ambiance and the pomp and circumstance and all the other things that seem to be really glamorous because we're there to work. And so I'm totally fine with the fact that that just puts me in a hall with a desk and in the bleachers, kind of really nose to the grindstone, really getting work done because that's what I came to do.
That's really interesting. Yeah. Because there is a lot of show business that when it comes to the State House, it was intentional when it was developed and it certainly creates an intangible feeling when you enter that building, no matter for what, for any reason. You can, I mean, even just to go and tour it, you know, you get a certain feeling.
Yeah, there are a lot of theatrics actually to the political show that is Rhode Island. And so for me, right from the get-go, right from the beginning, I like to pull the veil back a little bit. I like to show what's really kind of going on. So the fact that we get to use something as painful and as horrible as COVID to actually do that in some way is a little bit redemptive for me. So I do love the fact that we get to pull the veil back and really what's happening behind all the marble and the draperies and, you know, and the show and the theatrics is really people that have a job to do. And are we actually doing it? So I kind of like that some of that has fallen away.
Let's kind of go all the way back to, I guess, where you came from, who you are, all that business, and how you made your way to the point where eventually in a primary, you knocked off Senator Billy Connolly, who was chair of the Finance Committee and a rather, you know, institutionalist type of character here in the state, no doubt about it.
Yeah, I never envisioned myself running for office. That was something that was not, in the stars, I thought, for me. But my community really felt that they needed someone that was going to represent their interests and working class people over special interests and not voting lockstep with the political establishment and the Senate president every single time. And so after I got over the crazy idea that, oh, that's me, that's who they want. Then it was all in, you know, and talking to people and talking to the community really revealed how much is left to be done. You know, yes, we built a very strong campaign. There were a lot of people having conversations on the doors, but some of my campaign was built by my predecessor because of things that weren't done. So I often say that part of my campaign was built, you know, by Billy Connolly, by, you know, not knocking doors, not listening to people, by assuming that, you know, when you look down his voting record, it was exactly in line with leadership, never questioning, never pushing back. How much can you actually be listening to the people of East Providence and Pawtucket when you're so in lockstep with leadership? I don't think you can.
Yeah, and certainly in his case, you know, it was a situation where, I haven't spoken with him. I don't know if you have, but it seemed to me that race was, he thought he had it locked up, and it was a sort of surprise when you were able to defeat him. Did he speak to you afterwards or anything?
Yeah, I got a message of congratulations. You know, it wasn't a small win. You know, it was the 62-38, so it was a huge win.
Yep.
And I think it reveals something. It'd be really interesting to see if they learn from this, because the biggest kryptonite there was that really not taking this seriously, not taking me seriously, and not, and really underestimating. I'm used to that. Woman of color, working class, like I'm used to being underestimated. But after underestimating me, you've underestimated the community. You've underestimated a slate of candidates across the state who are not there by accident. We're there because of people being really fed up with a state house that's not representing them. And so really underestimate, I think it's a combination of both underestimating myself, other candidates, underestimating the working class people and their level of fed upness, and then also overestimating their power. We often like to talk about, oh, how powerful, you know, leadership is and how the political establishment is, but it's a fragile power that can easily, as we've shown, you know, be overtaken just due to their sheer negligence.
That margin of victory is significant because it shows that it wasn't a fluke, that it was a situation where people, even those to get to that type of number, you have to be able to reach people outside, especially in a primary, outside of the bubble of progressivism, whatever you want to call it, active engagement in left-leaning politics, whatever it is. You have to pull in people who are moderates, who are not that engaged in the process. So that must have been the key area that was underestimated, would be my assessment.
Yeah. I mean, we won every precinct, every single precinct, even in Pawtucket, every single precinct. So when you look at the poll numbers, when they were rolling in, every single one, there was a different margin of win, you know, but we won. And so, yeah, I think the unifying factor here is people are ready to have their voices heard in the state house. And they're fed up with anyone or anything that kind of stands in the way. And so just giving people the idea, the hope that they can be represented. It's exciting. People got really, really excited. And yes, you're right. They can't, not everyone can check every single box down the very extensive platform that we had, right? 12 policy points. But what they know and what they're able to identify is genuineness, hard work. This is not easy. So they also understand the a level of sacrifice. And so there is this, people are really upset and kind of frustrated with a self-serving government. And we've seen that over and over again, you know, in this state. So they see themselves. They see themselves in us. They see hardworking people that just want to do the right thing. And if I firmly believe that if we had more people like that are in our community in the state house, our state house would look completely different. And that's what that's what the political establishment's afraid of, is that the state house fundamentally would look different if working class people were represented there.
Yeah, it would be a complete version of a bloodless revolution, so to speak. Yeah. What do you think it would take for, you know, you look at District 39, where Megan Cotter put up an incredible effort against Justin Price. I mean, here's Justin Price. Turns out he's down at the Capitol riot. I mean, the guy is pretty much, even within the Republican Party, he's been marginalized. In fact, he was almost primaried by Jerry Zarella in that District 39 Republican, what would be primary. But how does that message translate on a statewide basis? You were so successful. Jonathan Acosta, so successful. Tierra Mack, so successful. There were areas where in Warwick, in some of the rural parts of the state, where the success was, there was progress, but it didn't get to the level that you were able to get to. What's your message to other districts about looking to not just the co-op, but candidates that want to represent what you espouse, you know, a genuine approach, working class approach, diverse approach? How does that get translated statewide?
You know, I think we will see it translated statewide. I think this is just the beginning. And what I've heard over and over again is that we're just asking for the basics. We're not asking for too much. We're asking for clean water. We're asking that when you work a full-time you know, job that you're able to pay to keep a roof over your head and food on your table. We're asking that our schools don't fall apart and educate our children. And while you're at it, protect our teachers and pay them well. And maybe let's not go broke or homeless when we need to seek medical attention. Let's not have to start a GoFundMe every single time we need to address our health. And so that's basic. And everyone agrees that that is the society that we should be moving toward and building. And that anything in the way of that, whether you're Republican or Democrat, anyone that's standing in the way of clean air, clean water, equity, working wages, fair wages, living wages, affordable healthcare, they are fundamentally opposed to the people. And you can put an R or a D by your name, but if you're standing in the way of that, then you need to go and you need to be primaried. So yeah, I'm excited for Megan. She came really, really close. I cannot wait to see her in the state house, you know, because I firmly believe she's going to take Price out.
Hey, do you want to reach tens of thousands of Rhode Islanders each month? And not just any Rhode Islanders who are plugged into politics, media, arts and culture, newsmakers, and all that is going on in the Ocean State. Well, we can help you do that through podcast, live stream, social media advertising, and much more. Send me an email, bill@ripodcast.com, or text me 401-524-6825. It's going to be interesting as we move forward into 2022, as the gubernatorial slate comes to fruition, as we see who is, you know, lieutenant governor, secretary of state. That'll be of influence as well. You got to wonder if Joe Polisena is taking a look at treasurer and how it'll all play out. But when we look back on 2018, Matt Brown was not particularly successful in moving the needle away from Gina Raimondo. However, on the lieutenant gubernatorial side, we saw Aaron Regenberg come very close to knocking off Dan McKee. So there is some precedent for statewide elections driving a more progressive view to at least close to victory. So how do you position yourself? How does the rest of the political co-op position themselves, regardless of who ends up being the nominee, if it's McKee, if it's Magaziner, Gorbea, or Lorza? Somehow, maybe, I'm not sure this will actually happen, but maybe Joe Paolino. How do you position yourself based on where 2022 goes in terms of, you know, being that voice of the people? Is that something you're going to have to consider?
Yeah, I think we position ourselves the same way that we have, is by kind of building a grassroots movement and really relying on a platform that represents people. For us, I think you're going to see more candidates than ever, more people than ever ready to come out and run for office. And I'm excited about that. And so one of the things that, you know, when we're talking about, yes, I ran for District 18, East Providence and Pawtucket, but I ran with a slate. We were already thinking about the entire Rhode Island. We were already thinking about the entire state, because we ran with people like you were just talking about, South County, Warwick, you know, Pawtucket. We're all across the state. So we, although yes, I have my finger on the pulse of my community, we've been thinking statewide the whole time, because the entire state has problems. The entire state needs help. And so until we have, you know, representation for working class people across the state, you know, it doesn't matter. So I'm excited to kind of see that on all levels. And we're going to keep pushing everyone, and we're going to keep running, keep getting people to run for office.
What are some of your personal goals this session, next session, as far as whether it's legislative priorities or just sort of broad opinions that you'll be able to insert into the halls of government?
I'm glad you asked. So I am excited about a few things. So I am able to join the Physicians of National Health on a Medicare for All study bill that's kind of been circulating, you know, the State House for a while, and it's not actually made it out of committee. So I'm hopeful this time we actually can get a study, which is a really low bar. That's a low ask here, is that we can just accomplish a study on this. And so I am really excited about seeing that coming to fruition. And we are also... I'm very excited about the legislative package that Tiara Mack is leading with Jonathan Acosta and Kendra for green housing and green jobs and green justice and the green justice zones, particularly because far too often we've had green justice at the expense of racial justice. And it's it's enough. We need both. And so I'm really, really excited about kind of working with my colleagues on that and championing that work, as well as seeing, advocating for women. We have the need for women in the trades, for union jobs, for women on boards. So you'll see some legislation that will kind of address the gender gap there. So I'm excited to kind of work on those things.
What about post COVID-19 with everything that's been exposed in terms of inequity and just major problems in our society? What do you take away from that as an elected official? What are the biggest areas we need to address?
Yeah, this one's really hard for me because I was personally affected by COVID-19. I lost my father to COVID-19.
Oh, I'm so sorry. Wow.
Yeah, thank you. In a nursing facility. So I know firsthand, you know, the kind of struggle there. I marched with our CNAs and our nurses, you know, with SEIU for the Raise the Bar campaign. I've applauded Senator Goodwin and her work with that. And so I've been really, and I would have done that anyway, whether a senator or not, because I know what they're going through. And so it really frightens me and shakes me to my core that the things that we're asking for our healthcare workers and our essential workers may actually not come to fruition because of the House. I mean, we're getting things done in the Senate and we're collaborating, we're speaking up, we're pushing the needle. We've seen in just the short time that I've been here, we've already addressed the $15 minimum wage. We've already addressed, you know, safe staffing. So a charter moratorium, like we are moving, but how far is that going to get with the leadership in the House? I'm not confident. And so that is all the more reason to our previous point to have more people run for office. We need more people that are willing to, that are not going to buckle when lives are on the line. So COVID has absolutely created an immense sense of urgency around the things that we already knew was a problem, that people were already suffering. I will have no mercy on anyone that stands in the way of making sure that our essential workers are protected, our teachers are protected, and no mercy should be had because lives are being lost. And this is not, it's not a joke.
It's really interesting how the Senate, certainly with the number of progressive candidates that have come in, and also the pressure that, frankly, Lenny Seo put on Senate President Ruggiero by winning Providence and nearly, I mean, within reason, nearly knocking off the Senate President, Dominic Ruggiero. But it's interesting how the Senate side has been, okay, yeah, as you mentioned, $15 minimum wage, you know, these policies, even cannabis, things that are not necessarily going to take off in the House. That imbalance, it sort of exposes a leadership vacuum on the House side that we've known about forever. You know, my whole life growing up here in Rhode Island, it was sort of a, you know, I registered as an independent, you know, when I was 18, because it was like, well, the Democrats here aren't real Democrats. You know, it's like well known that it's a much more conservative and gentle approach to some of these major issues.
Yeah.
Do you think that the Senate will have the ability, though, to influence either through backroom, terrible term, but through like, you know, meet, you know, just the advocating, if you will, out of the halls of government, through optics, through public pressure in the media, whatever it is? Do you think that Joe Shikarchi will have to make pivots in certain issues for his own political future because of what's happening inside the Senate?
Yeah, so This is an important thing to kind of know about me. My hope has always been with the people. Yeah. So my hope is actually not in the Senate leadership. My hope is in the people. And so we have seen people march in the streets. We have seen people email. We have seen people run for office that we never thought would run before. And so that pressure will always come from the outside. Progress will always come from the outside. It will always be the people that are left outside of the halls of decision making who will put the most pressure on those people of leadership. I cannot trust that the people that are comfortable, the people that have the power, that have hoarded it for so long, will wield it well. They haven't proven that to me. But what I do know is that when it comes time to push, come to shove, and that we see more of the same in the state, in the House, different face, different names, same story, that my trust, my hope is that the people will not allow it. That's how I got here. That's how many of my friends got here. And if they don't get it right, they will be gone.
Yeah. I mean, that's really at the end of the day, that's a much wider net to cast. And then just going after three or four people in leadership roles, you know, there are 700,000 adults in Rhode Island that
care.
Care. Yeah.
They care. They care. And they're done with a leadership that doesn't. And so that's my hope. You know, I didn't run for office to be the hope for anyone. I ran for office because the people have hope, and my hope is the people. And so they give me hope every single day. So I'm not reliant on the Senate to kind of make the House do anything. I'm reliant on the people in the streets who we have essential workers who got hazard pay for 30 days.
Yeah.
While we're a year into COVID. I expect those people to start marching and hollering and running for office and sending letters and organizing until they're not comfortable anymore. Let's make them a little uncomfortable. They're way too comfortable. They're way too comfortable while people are in pain. It's not acceptable.
Completely agree. It's completely outrageous. And when we look back on this in 100 years, it'll be in the history books of, wow, there was a division of opportunity that came from COVID, that was exposed by COVID. And now, the next decade, the roaring 20s, if you will, that we're hoping to have, what actually happens? What really comes out of what we've learned? How many people have been hypnotized by corporate news and garbage and, you know, just sort of the sense that they have no power versus how many people say, wait a second, it wasn't all that long ago that we were all disorganized on this earth, just wandering around trying to figure out how to build a society. This isn't the sun. This isn't atoms. This isn't, you know, the stars or anything like that. This is brand new and as in the grand scheme of things. So undo it.
And we're the creators of it. We can shape this future. It is not, you know, it's not fantastic. It's not unreasonable. You know, in the wake of all of this destruction that we're seeing, we are able to create a society that is equitable. It is within our grasp. And every single time that we forfeit our voice, every single time, you know, that we allow someone who is a quote unquote leader to make a decision that we know is compromising, you know, we let that future slip away. And I think that, you know, I'm excited about the fact that the resounding message is no more, you know, no longer. So I look forward to those roaring 20s that we may see.
Yeah, let's hope. I mean, I think there's a great opportunity for social justice. There's a great opportunity for the arts. There's a great opportunity for education and for just a revelation of people who previously have seen a lot of these fights, these battles as something that's like, oh, that's a bunch of maniacs that, you know, that the bunch of people who they you know, college kids that just are dreaming. This is just pie in the sky. This isn't how the real world works. Like, I think people are going to wake up and go, oh, wait a minute. This is totally doable.
Totally doable.
And we don't necessarily have to act violently. In fact, we shouldn't act violently for the most part. Mm-hmm. You know, obviously, if someone has their boot on your chin, it's tough to just lay there and take it. But for the most part, this is that process of just inserting the people into the institutions of government, media, education, healthcare, et cetera. And I think you're right. I think that that's where the hope is, in the people.
That's all I'm interested in doing, inserting the people in those places. That's it. All right.
My last question. What do you, because we had Senator Mack on recently and discussing her bunny. And I see some wonderful plants behind you. As I mentioned, I've become a plant dad here. You know, I've got, they all have names.
Yeah.
I have like a rotation of sunlight and water, and it's like a real challenge. And, it's really kept me at times like afloat, like managing my plants. But what do you do for fun?
Yeah, so I have a 17-year-old daughter, and we have a lot of fun. She's an artist. So COVID has produced a lot of amazing art in my house. Mm-hmm. So we have a lot of fun with that. And just me being the recipient, I have my own art gallery here where awesome. she is pumping out stuff left and right and exploring and really having a little bit of that time now to really, really, to really push herself in that area and just kind of really envelop herself in her work. And it's been fun to watch. So for us, that's been a big thing. And then yes, my plant life is definitely improving. I have some plants that are not only surviving, but thriving now.
Yeah, it's a fun thing when you see the improvement and the growth and having to, oh man, you've got to get a larger pot for this one. Yeah. And it's like, is this soil the right soil?
Yeah. Should I go to the propagating? Like,
yes.
Amazing.
So I'd fun. Like to see a plant elected to, I don't know if it's a waste of space. Obviously, it'd be difficult to discern if how they're voting. I don't know if you could prove that.
We have a few statues. Why can't we have a plant?
Seriously. Yeah. Cynthia Mendez, ladies and gentlemen, and enjoy Rick, Rhode Island College. Have fun.
I will. Thank you so much for having me on, Bill. This was such a blast.
Oh, I'm so glad we did it. It's a long time coming. So,
Rhode Island's podcast of record, B-Town.
At HealthSource RI for Employers, we provide access to health insurance to more than 1,100 local businesses and nonprofits, and 96% of them renew through us every year. Maybe it's our choice of 19 different health plans, our 10 years of customizing solutions, or our one local team of dedicated experts helping employers find quality health insurance. See how our numbers stack up for you. Learn more at healthsourceri.com/employers.